The sciences have the Nobel Prize, there's the Heisman in football, but if you are a journalist, the ultimate recognition of excellence is the Pulitzer Prize, and today's guest has one of those. Connie Schultz was honored in 2005 for distinguished commentary for her Cleveland Plain Dealer columns that the Pulitzer Committee said provided, quote, a voice for the underdog and the underprivileged. Today she joins us to talk about the journalism profession and her views on the America we live in. Connie Schultz with us on Town Hall, Ohio.
This is Town Hall, Ohio, home to interesting people, engaging issues, and enlightening stories. Town Hall, Ohio is a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, working to forge a partnership between farmers and consumers, and is supported by Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Now, here's Town Hall, Ohio host, Joe Corneli.
Connie Schultz has an impressive resume as a communicator and an advocate. She is an Ashtabula native, a Kent State University grad, former writer for The Plain Dealer of Cleveland and Parade Magazine, currently a nationally syndicated columnist and a professional in residence back at Kent State. In addition to the aforementioned Pulitzer Prize, she recently received the Progressive Hero of the Year Award, that from the public policy advocacy group Progress Ohio. And there's one other note about Connie you probably should know. She is married to Ohio's senior senator, Sherrod Brown. Connie, welcome to Town Hall, Ohio. It's a privilege to have you on with us today.
Thank you, Joe. It's great to be here.
And one real important question. What are you more proud of, the Pulitzer Prize or 168,000 followers on Facebook? Both are impressive.
Maybe one led to the other. I'm not sure, but I love doing Facebook. I love being on Facebook.
Well, we're going to talk about Facebook. We're going to talk about the Pulitzer. We might even talk a little bit about your husband, if that's okay,
well,
a little bit later in
that.
The show. But one of the main things I wanted to get you in here for, we've had opportunity over the years to invite journalists in to talk about the practice of the profession. And having been a reporter for 20 years, it's a subject near and dear to my heart. Start off with your view of what it means to be a journalist, a good journalist.
I just answered a question.
I'm going to have you pull that microphone just a little closer.
There I answered that question, a similar question yesterday from one of my colleagues at Kent State. My answer about journalism, when you compare it to all the other ways to communicate, it's the least sexy, but the most important, I think, of the ways that we communicate in this country, because journalism, good journalism, is the last stop between us and mammoth corruption in government. And I don't know how you can have, I know you can't have a thriving democracy without a thriving free press.
So I was going to ask you why it mattered. You explained that. You and I are contemporaries, about the same age. Mm-hmm. We've seen the profession develop, evolve. Give us your take on how things have changed from when you were a cub reporter.
Well, of course, there's no point having a conversation about journalism if we're not going to talk about how the internet changed everything for us, including the business model. And that means that things can go up very quickly. We can post quickly. I will always object to the term update if it's actually a correction, however. That is one of the problems with immediately posting too often, I think. We don't catch ourselves in the way we traditionally have. I make no apology for being a traditional journalist and championing the standards that existed when I first got into the industry and was one of the reasons I wanted to get into it. I still think it's one of the most honorable things you can do for a living. It's a mission, not a job. And so when we look at the changes that have happened, we see all the cuts in newspapers across the country. You know, when I started at the Plain Dealer in December of 93, we had more than 400 guild members. They have fewer than 100 now. And they are in three different locations. They've separated the guild from the rest of the newsroom operation. I mean, it's pretty stunning, as an example, to see what's happened with newsrooms and newspapers. A lot of our colleagues, our cohorts, are gone. They either they were laid off or they took buyouts. And I teach millennials because, first of all, I love millennials. I love journalism. And I am so concerned that we help train them, especially now as we're on the precipice of a Trump administration, that we train them on how to be the best they can be, upholding traditional standards and values of journalism while embracing everything that we have available now because of the internet and because of technology.
I want to come back to the practice of journalism, but you mentioned the business model change. For a person who doesn't feel the need to follow what's going on in that that particular industry. How has that model changed?
Well, one of the biggest mistakes, the newspaper industry, which that's where I come from, so let's address that first. One of the biggest mistakes the newspaper industry made is we didn't take the internet seriously. Owners and publishers did not. If we had listened to some of our younger staff members 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we would have known that it is here to stay, that we need to incorporate it as part of our business model, which means that from the beginning we should have been paying, requiring readers to pay for content online. I hate that they call it content. Our coverage, our stories and our photographs and increasingly our videos. But I think except for the Wall Street Journal, who did it early, knew was smart. They had a niche market, and they really knew how to exploit that. We gave it all for free and gave it away for free. And once you've done that, it's very hard to convince readers to start paying. We are seeing an uptick in subscriptions, digital and print, but especially digital. The Washington Post and the New York Times have both reported. Both of them have reported upticks. The Washington Post is hiring 60 more journalists in the wake of this last presidential race. And I hope that means that readers and consumers of news are starting to understand why it matters so much that you have journalists paid to do this for a living.
The ability to pay that journalist is dependent upon revenue coming into the publisher.
Yes.
Either via subscription, and you've already explained we don't charge a quote-unquote subscription online.
Some do now. Some do.
And or advertising. And even the you could charge more when you promised X thousand eyeballs on a piece of paper versus clicks or impressions. Talk a little bit about how the inability of owners, publishers to monetize what they're doing is having that impact.
Well, of course, that is the other part of this. Advertising plummeted. And we, because we were giving it away for free on the web, there was not much incentive, I think, to convince advertisers to move their ads to our websites, but we had another problem with our websites, and that was unmoderated comment sections. I liken it to the cesspool. I mean, a bad district, if you want to find a nice bar, you're not going to go to the worst side of town. You're not going to hang out there. And unfortunately, that's what happened with too many comment sections on newspapers around the country. It was the worst. It was anonymous, and we know how vile that can get so quickly. I know it from very direct experience. I remember an editor once saying to me, "Why are you complaining? The only stories that get more comments in your columns are the sports stories." And I said, but have you seen what they're saying in the comment sections? We lose readers so fast that they're not going to wade in there and participate, which is how I got started on Facebook.
Our guest today, I should remind folks, Connie Schultz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, now an educator. I assume that's the correct term at Kent State University.
Let us hope that's what I'm doing. It's certainly my job title.
At Kent State University, and an advocate, too, for many of the things that she thinks we should be looking at as important issues in our lives as members of society. So much for the business model of journalism. What did you learn when you went? Did you go to J school?
I did.
Okay, so you went to J school, and now you are back with the millennials, hopefully helping develop their skills. What did you learn then that's still important that you want to convey now?
I want to start by mentioning that I was the first in my family to go to college, and 40% of Kent State students are still the first in their family to go to college, which is one of the reasons I wanted to go back to Kent. They have an excellent journalism school, but they have a lot of kids like me, right? And if whatever I bring to it that they want to learn, I hope they see themselves in me in some way, right? Much of what I was taught in journalism school, I still teach. I teach mostly upper-level courses, feature writing, opinion writing. I'm going to be teaching ethics. This semester, we talk about ethics in all my classes, but this will be a concentrated course. And in many ways, that hasn't the basic standards haven't changed. I always tell my students in the beginning of the semester, we talk about their values and their biases. And I say it's really important to understand both what you stand for and what can get in your way of seeing something fairly. Not objectively. I don't believe in objectivity. It's a myth. We're humans. Anything we see, we refract through the lens of our own experience. What's important is to know where our blind spots are so that we don't let them get in the way of our coverage. So we talk a lot about that. There is no substitute for reporting, whether it's writing an editorial or a column, or working on a feature story. You know, that's where my concentration is when I'm teaching. it starts with the reporting. And there is absolutely no substitute for it. You must confirm, as I said this week about, as you know, BuzzFeed, the news organization, leaked the full dossier of the supposed intelligence report, secret report about cooperation between Russia and President-elect Trump, none of which has been confirmed. Many reporters have had it for months and have been trying to run that down. But BuzzFeed posted it and even said, we can't confirm this, but we think you should know and you decide if it's the truth. That is not how we function as journalists. And I made clear in my column, and that will never happen in my classroom. You have got to be able to confirm what you've got. And this is an important conversation we need to be having in our profession right now.
You said reporting, crucial to any type of storytelling. What makes a good reporter? What kind of skills should someone come away with out of their training that helps them be a good reporter?
So many reporters I know, there's some of the best, are kind of, I like to describe newsrooms often, we are the land of misfit toys. Remember Rudolph the Red-Nosed
sure.
Reindeer? We're not particularly socially functional, many of us, but we have such a curiosity about the world, and we have the training and that gives us the expectation that we are entitled to ask questions. We are particularly, where that's most important, I think, often, is when we're talking about elected officials and government agencies. We are the people's voice. We ask the questions that, most people feel like they could never even get a phone call answered, right? That's our job, to ask those questions. So an insatiable curiosity goes without saying. I also think the best reporters read a lot of great reporting and a lot of great writing, and they read fiction. I love fiction, and I'm working almost done with my first novel after writing two nonfiction books. And I know so many journalists who read fiction, particularly in the evenings. It makes you a better writer, and just as importantly, I think, it helps you understand who you are.
Who's your favorite nonfiction and fiction writers?
I don't have. I couldn't possibly tell you that. It seems to be often the book that's in my hand at the moment.
Yeah.
I will say that I've read The New Yorker since I was 17 years old. That's when I first started subscribing. This working class kid in Ashtabula. I was diagnosed with severe asthma at 16, so I was constantly in my doctor's office. And he had The New Yorker on his table, and he let me start taking them home. And I would bring them back, and I fell in love with the writing. I often joke that the cartoons made no sense to me at the time, and now I'm living them. So I guess that's what age gives you, right?
Got about a minute before we have to go to break. I mentioned at the top that in journalism, a Pulitzer is a really big deal. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What'd that feel like?
There is nothing like it. It changes your life. And then 2 days later, you have another deadline. And I often remind people, journalists, they want to know what it felt like and all that. But I remind anybody who asks that while it's such a great honor to win the Pulitzer, it will never hold me at night and it will never tell me it loves me. So it's important to keep it in perspective.
Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. Hers was for commentary in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Has moved on to other activities in the journalism profession, including a nationally syndicated column. We're going to be back to talk further with Connie Schultz about the journalism profession and some thoughts on life in contemporary America. We'll be back with Connie Schultz on Town Hall, Ohio, right after this. Connie Schultz is in the studio. Oh, we're just getting started with the bumper music, Connie.
I love that song.
You know, it's so funny. Your husband has been on the show probably as much as anybody, and he always really tunes into the music, too. You guys both must be music fans.
We are.
So we've talked about journalism and what the people who do it should be doing well, what the gatekeeper should be doing is in terms of who owns the delivery system. But what about Rebecca and me and the average person who picks up a newspaper on Sunday mornings or goes online to a website or listens to the radio? What can we do? What should we do to be good consumers of journalism?
I'm so glad you asked that. I would not describe you or Rebecca as average, but let's proceed. One of the things I've been really encouraging people to do in the last, I would say, 6-7 months, it's become a cause of mine, is when you're on social media, for example, and you see a story that you want to share, I want you to pay attention to what stories you're tending to share, and then I want you to pay attention to what news organization they're coming from, and then please buy a digital subscription. Because if these are news sites that you support, I mean, that you think are credible and they're helpful, and of course, that's a big if, right? That's a different conversation. But if you're finding news sources that you trust, please fund them. Please pay that little bit of extra money. Most people can afford it, not everyone, and I would never suggest that you give up electricity to subscribe. But if you can, it really helps. But also, let's talk about how to know when something is credible. I love the thought of still, I liken buying a newspaper, a print copy, to walking through a bookstore and you think you go in, or a library, and you think you know which book you want, and then you see all these other things that also interest you. That's what a newspaper is. You know, if you go to the homepage, that's one way to read it, but there's nothing like holding it in your hand. Same with a magazine. I understand that by the time you and I mean, let us live long lives, we probably won't see much of that anymore. But right now, they still exist. And one of the reasons I encourage it is this. We really have to be careful that we're not exposing ourselves only to things that confirm our bias. That's why I read conservative columnists. I read the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which it's kind of fun. Whichever of us gets it in the house first, that's the person whose hair is on fire within 15 minutes. And we're reading it out loud to each other from whatever exercise thing we're doing. But it's important to expose ourselves to something other than what already we think we know.
Talk for a little bit about just the checks and balances that are on reporting of stories for a journalist versus somebody that has a keyboard and a mouse.
Well, I'm worried that the differences are diminishing because they're cutting staff so much. But in the ideal world, and certainly at the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, the bigger papers, a reporter turns in a story, a copy editor is going to look at it at least. So you do have some of those checks. When you've got somebody who's just decided to post an opinion from a keyboard, some are quite ethical. Yeah, over time, they've learned that that's how you build an audience, and that's how you gain any credibility, particularly with the media, which, as much as they say they hate us, they all want us to cover them, right? Is you've got to confirm. You've got to be able to research, and you have to name, and you go by your own name. I mean, I love when they go after me on Twitter. One of the things I love telling them is, yes, I do get paid to write these opinions, and I use my own name, too. Because to me, that is one of the crucial differences. You know who I am. I stand behind everything I write.
And you mentioned everybody wants to be covered. So a quick tip there. Our farmers want to interact with their local media pretty regularly. And,
yes.
And part of what I do is spend some time helping them understand how to do that. What are your quick tips on? So you want a reporter's attention. What's a good way to pitch your story?
I think it really helps to have some narrative you're offering. If you have an example of something that illustrates the story you're trying to tell. Also, don't assume that reporters know what they're talking about when it comes to farms and the farming industry. Don't be afraid to respectfully provide additional information and ask them what else they need to know. Agriculture is such a big beat, as you know. It's such an important beat. And I think more readers and television viewers are in. Radio listeners are interested in it now because so many are more interested in the farm-to-table movement, for example, and the growing number of farmers markets and the community gardens that have been growing up. So even though your story may be something that's very important to farmers in Southeast Ohio, let's say, there's a way to reach people that wasn't as easy to do even 5 years ago because so many people want to call themselves farmers now because they've got, you know, container plants with tomatoes growing. Exploit that.
Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, our guest on the show today. I want to get started in this before we have to go to break. I read a piece on the review on the website of the Columbia Journalism Review. It said you were a reluctant adopter of Facebook and now have 168,000 followers. And I want to read this. Columbia Journalism Review wrote that in an era when journalists feel pressure to use social media to build their personal brands, Connie Schultz has done something far more interesting. She's adapted the classic newspaper column to her Facebook page, bringing the best of traditional form, newsiness, insight, journalistic principles, and personality to a forum that often serves as a narrower vehicle for self-promotion. Translate what you're doing, what I just read there.
Well, that was Ann Clark, and I have been so appreciative to her for writing that story for Columbia Journalism Review, because it really it took my Facebook page to a different level, and it was a way to acknowledge the community we had built there. I was reluctant at first with Facebook. I thought, oh gosh, another place where we're going to have a bunch of people just talking at one another. But when I realized that with Facebook, you can require the identities of people who are posting in response to stories and columns, but they can still engage with on different issues. I opened it up to the public fairly quickly because it was getting leaked anyway, the conversations we were having. And it started growing because the community started looking out for one another and for me. And they will tag me when a troll shows up, for example. If your listeners don't know what a troll, well, we can get into that.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit, not much about trolls,
no,
but we'll touch on
let's
trolls
skip them.
When we get back to our interview with Connie Schultz right after this.
Okay.
Now, does that not fit what we've been talking about?
I love that.
Connie Schultz is in the studio with us, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and talking about the journalism profession with us today. And we've sort of moved along into what happens now in the social media space. Connie is a big hit on Facebook, lots of followers. You talked about one of the reasons your Facebook page works so well is you don't allow anonymity. If somebody wants to say something, they've got to put their name behind it. What else do you try to do with that Facebook page that it's built a community around itself?
It has. Well, and of course, some people can make up identities, right? If they're
sure.
behaving well, I can't be concerned about that. But as soon as they behave badly, I often notice that they have maybe three Facebook friends, no picture. There's a reason for that. They're out to troll. One of the things I learned pretty early is don't post just your own stuff. Don't make it a vanity exercise. I decided it was two things for me. It was a way to lead discussions and build a community of discussions around issues I care about, and in addition to sharing my own stories. And because I'm married to a United States senator and I'm a columnist, I thought the best way to own that and be as transparent as I can is make it also about my family life. So everybody knows our dog, Franklin. He's the most popular. As Sherrod said, if the three of us show up, we know who's getting all the pictures. It's going to be Franklin. And because the thing is, even if you hate my politics, but you love animals, or you were a single parent for a long time, like both Sherrod and I were, there are ways to close the distance with your readers. And these are all attempts on my part to do that so that we can have conversations about just about anything, and we do.
So do you ever find yourself, I'm sure that the columns you write for your newspaper column
yes,
end up there.
Every time.
Does it work in the opposite? Do you end up with ideas from the Facebook page that get turned into columns?
Oh, sure, sometimes.
And then does the universe collapse on itself when you write about it?
Yeah, well, I try to acknowledge whenever, if I'm going to quote anybody from Facebook, I get their permission. But sometimes somebody will say something, and you know how this works as a journalist, and you get an idea you hadn't even thought of because somebody went in a different direction. And one of my favorite questions to ask, and I only ask it about every 6 to 8 weeks, I'll just say, what's on your mind? And it unfolds in the hundreds so quickly. And you've got somebody who's trying to decide if she's finally going to buy that red pair of twinkly shoes next to somebody who's trying to decide if this is the moment to take their father off the ventilator. I mean, it is an incredible thing of what, and I often show it to Sherrod and say, this is what you're up against. This is what you're competing against. This is what's going on in America. And it's the same for journalism. This is what we're up against, trying to get people's attention. There is so much going on in their worlds.
Connie Schultz, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, in the studio with us. The author of several books and a novel coming soon, or at some point, we'll say.
Almost done to be turned into
But I love the title, partial title of one of your books, And His Lovely Wife. A memoir of marrying Sherrod Brown and his run for the Senate. You left your job at the Plain Dealer when Sherrod decided he was going to run for the U.S. Senate.
I took a leave of absence. It's not your normal move within months of winning the Pulitzer. But once we decided that he was going to run, I was writing at that time for what was the largest newspaper in Ohio. So I did take a leave of absence. My editor, Kate Medina at Random House, they'd already done a collection of my columns and essays, said immediately, why don't we do a book on the race? And I think our family and Kate Medina at Random House were the only ones who thought he could win at that time. He did win by about 12 points against Mike DeWine in 06. The title came about because, this is how it works with publishing. They immediately want a title, right? Can you tell us what the title's going to be? And I'm on the road, and I'm filling Moleskine notebooks. And finally, it occurred to me, it was the time because you can't believe how quickly it happens. You go from being what you think is, okay, I've done it. I'm a columnist. To Sherrod Brown's here and his lovely wife. And the one that finally gave me the title is when he said, and his lovely wife, Candy, is here. And I told Sherrod, I just waved. Nobody cared what my name was anyway. And I called my editor and said, I think I have the title for this book.
I'll have to admit, I haven't read it, but after talking with you, I think I want to.
Thank you.
One of the things I know that you do talk about in the book, though, kind of came as a shock to you. You're a member of the press. You're a journalist. You're a card-carrying newspaper woman. And when you become the wife, or you're transformed into being the wife of a Senate candidate, that relationship with the press change somewhat?
Initially, part of it was my colleagues. That's one of the reasons I took the leave. They didn't know what to do with me. So many of them had come to me for advice. Several of the political reporters had been at our wedding, and all of a sudden they're covering us, so I didn't want to make it complicated for them. One of the things I discovered over time is that the regional media were so strong compared to the national media, who swoop in, do a story, and swoop out. They don't really know Ohio. I don't need to tell your audience that. They didn't really understand the Senate race in the same way that I had never been in a race, so I was learning a lot. I covered them. I had never been in one. It's so different when you're inside it. But I actually, overall, had a lot of respect for my colleagues out there in the way they covered it. I was really proud of them.
One other item that I think you get into a little bit in the book, the impact of being in this on your family and the kinds of demands it puts on a marriage. I want to get into that with you in just a couple of moments, but we need to go to break. Connie Schultz is in the studio with us, nationally syndicated columnist, educator at Kent State University, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. We'll be back to talk more with Connie when we continue on Town Hall, Ohio. So we're talking about being married to a gentleman who wants to become a United States Senator and giving us that first-person perspective, Connie Schultz, journalist, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and wife of Ohio Senior Senator Sherrod Brown. Now, I'm sure there wasn't, I imagine there wasn't this moment that just out of the blue, Sherrod came to you and said, you know, I think I'm going to run for the Senate. How did that affect you, other members of the family, the friends that you have? Being a U.S. senator comes with, I'm going to use the term baggage, but it comes with some responsibility. It's got to change your relationship with family and friends.
Well, so to break that down, it brought Sherrod and me closer. We'd only been married since 2004, right? Anyway, we had met in 2003. And so the Senate race was a joint decision that I held up. I wasn't sure that I wanted him to run. I was scared. Then, believe it or not, I write about this in the book, and Martin Sheen has become a dear friend of ours. We were watching some reruns of West Wing, and we saw
great the show.
I know. And it is. And we saw the first two episodes of season two, and I turned it off, and I turned to Sherrod and said, you got to run. And he said, I really do, don't I? That's pretty much how we did it. My two kids, we each brought two children into the marriage, and now we just think of ourselves as four children, five grandchildren. But back then, my children were two children of journalists, right? We didn't have political posters in the yard, no signs, no bumper stickers, and all of a sudden they felt liberated, of course. But my favorite story about that is my daughter was 19 at the time, and they ran this horrible ad that was false about Sherrod. And she calls me from a bathroom in a restaurant, and she's crying. And I said, what's the matter? She goes, they said horrible things about Sheridan. I know how much he gives to charity. That's why I don't have a new car. And I said, no, honey, you don't have a new car because we're not buying you a new car. But it was such a Caitlin moment at that time.
One other note I saw as someone reviewed the book, they said you talked about my word, not yours, the horror of having your life turned over to a bunch of kids, young people, young staffers.
But you know what? That's part of the reason I love millennials, because, you know, Sherrod ran again in 12 and won. And so we have all these young people on staff, and they are, of course, the activists of their generation. But my gosh, the commitment they have to the country and to doing good in the world, which we know about millennials, they are the most socially conscious generation since FDR's. Think about that. Once I explain to them who FDR is, it's a great conversation.
Well, let's talk about some of those social issues in no particular order or from any era. I just want to have you share some thoughts on things that, as I went through preparing for today and reviewed some of your recent columns, your Pulitzer columns, women's issues seem to be a common theme through the years. What's a middle-aged white guy like me need to think about in terms of making sure that I'm sensitive to what are the current issues important to women?
Well, you just illustrated it. You asked. I mean, I always answer that every issue is a woman's issue. That's part of what I hope I reflect in my column. Of course, I care about women's reproductive rights. I care about women getting fair pay for their work. I care that you ask questions like that where it's clear that you're trying to understand. I'm married to a guy like you, middle-aged white guy. And one of the reasons I fell in love with him is he has such a high regard for women, period. And that matters. But just as importantly to me, I care about the people who work, the hourly wage earners of our country. You know, my parents were both. My dad worked for the utility company for 36 years. He was a member of the Utility Workers Union. My mother was a stay-at-home mom and then a nurse's aide. And one of the things she taught all of us girls, her three daughters, and she has a son, His Highness, the son, and the three daughters, don't marry him until you see how he treats the waitress. And that drives my work, because what she meant, of course, is how we treat the people we're allowed to mistreat is the measure of who we are.
You wrote a column about a Cleveland television anchor who literally removed her clothes on television. What were your thoughts on that? What did you try to convey to the public that they should be thinking about when something like that happens?
I'm all for art, and that was part of a big art project. It's I'm drawing a blank on the artist's name, but the photographer, but he's done it around the country. What I objected to were two things: that the station talked her into it, and then they held it for ratings. And it was not something that I thought an anchor woman needed to be doing, but what became more puzzling was the more I interviewed, the scarier the column became. And it was just pretty, it reflected a lot of what's gone wrong with too much local broadcasting. I mean, I feel early on in my career, newspapers started to suffer because of what was happening at local television stations. And they were, what I really object when people get on Facebook and start talking about the media as if we're all bad. We really are a wide group. There are responsible broadcasters, both in radio and television, and there are responsible print journalists, and then there are the other guys. And I really want not to be lumped with them, because a lot of us work very hard to keep the standards. And I've helped judge the Pulitzers in the last 2 years. Unbelievable stuff still coming out of print journalism.
We will be back in just a couple of moments to wrap up our conversation. Boy, this time has flown by. Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and now an educator at Kent State University and nationally syndicated columnist. We'll wrap up with Connie right after this. So we're going to dump the rest of our conversation with Connie Schultz on journalism and society. And you met the boss twice. Wow. Now I'm really impressed. How much fun was that?
I will tell you this. I've never said it publicly. I don't think ever. The second time I met him, I was standing next to David Axelrod 2 nights before the election in 08. And I said, I've always wanted to. This is the first time I really talked to Bruce. I said, I've always wanted to meet Bruce Springsteen. He goes, well, that's great, because here he comes. So Sherrod's standing with me, and we talk a little bit, and he's walking away with his wife, Patty, and I just said, Bruce, thank you so much for coming to Cleveland. And he turned to me and he said, thank you for your columns. And here
wow.
I was running in the Asbury Times and didn't know it.
That is very
Sherrod
cool.
Sherrod said, it's the only time he ever saw me almost faint.
So we talked about some of the topics that have been kind of woven through your work over the years. You write about economic justice a lot, and You wrote a story, I think this was part of the Pulitzer Prize winning series. It talks about a tip jar at a restaurant, and you put the money in the jar only to find out that the young lady behind the counter didn't get it.
Our age or older.
Oh, okay.
African-American, already on her feet all evening, helping wait on the tables at this big gala, charitable gala. Tip jar is a jar, glass, full of money. Not just singles, but tens and fives, right?
And she doesn't get it. It goes to the owners.
Management kept the tips.
Okay, so you write that you talked to the spokesman who said, "I don't think anyone else cares who gets the tip." You write, "I think she's wrong." Fascinating thoughts there. Tell us what point you were making with that column.
When a jar says tips, it doesn't matter what your politics are, you expect the person behind the counter to get your tip. And they changed their policy that following morning. You'll appreciate this on the most popular radio station in Cleveland by 11 a.m. because the radio station climbed on it. I sat at my desk. My voicemail at that time held 90 calls at a time. I sat all day just listening and writing them out and deleting so that they wouldn't roll over to the secretaries because people were so angry all day long. I only had three people who had objected to what I wrote. Everybody said they should keep the tips. This launched a series of columns I've done over the years on tipping practices, including, can I just say this, please, to everybody, please tip in cash whenever you can. Because if you pay with a charge card and you put your tip on there, there's a chance that it's going to get deducted. Part of it, the service charge will be deducted from their tips, or they won't see any of it. Just pay them in cash.
And I'm going to throw mine in. You mentioned earlier, tip in cash. You mentioned earlier, pay for your news.
Yes.
Do the same with your music. Just don't swap music files. Pay. The artist
pay
has to get it.
We need our artists.
Yes. That's my two cents worth. As we close out the show, you clearly, from your writings, are not a Donald Trump fan. Your husband is a Democratic senator. How do we continue to exist when there are so many, so widely divergent opinions, so much animosity, hatred in our political system? What's the advice to Trump fans or folks who would have rather seen Hillary elected? How do we get along in the next 4 years?
Well, as I wrote in my column this week, I am seeing a renewed interest in journalism from a lot of people who had stopped paying attention because they care very much about the relationship that seems to be very poor. The president-elect hates us and has no problem saying that. That will not stop us from doing our jobs. Journalism is not an act of revenge. And reporting is not a grudge match. And the First Amendment empowers us to do our job. So I would ask of regular citizens, of whom we all are, that talk less, listen more. So advice a dear friend, Joan Klein, gave to me before she died a couple of years ago. She was just a wonderful, wonderful woman with six children and 16 grandchildren. And when I started to offer to pay for lunch, she had promised she was taking it. She says, "Connie, be quiet. Stop talking and listen more." I just think that's the best advice for all of us.
If folks want to read your columns, learn some of your thoughts, what's the easiest way to find you online?
Well, I don't know where their papers are when they're hearing, so the best way online is to go to creators.com, or you can join me on Facebook. I share a link to my column every Wednesday.
So if we just go on Facebook and search Connie Schultz?
Yep, there I am.
All right. Will you come back sometime?
I would love to.
It's been a ball.
Thank you so much.
Connie Schultz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist while she was at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, now a nationally syndicated columnist and educator at Kent State University, sharing some, I think, valuable insights into how we get our news, who we should get it from, and how we can become better consumers, and also some thoughts on the society in which we now live. Connie, thank you for being here, and thanks to all of you for tuning us in this week on Town Hall Ohio.
Thank you.
Town Hall Ohio is a project of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and is brought to you with the support of Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Join us again next week for Town Hall Ohio.